call me the late Mrs. Eddie, and I never really knew whether it was my habits or my condition, but sometimes I'm a little earlier than others, but this is an exception. You know, I had no idea that the airport was so damn far away. I mean, I've been complaining about California, but you've got us beat, I want you to know. Anyhow, my name is Winnie Eddy. I'm the wife of an alcoholic, a member of Al-Anon, and as I have many times said, I'm not always grateful for either one. And primarily, I guess, because when I came into Al-Anon, that was when my troubles really started. Now, that's sometimes hard for people to believe, but it's the truth. Because when I came into Al-Anon, I had three or four answers for any given situation. None of them worked, but it was a great delaying tactic for the disaster that usually followed. And when I got into Al-Anon, there was one answer, and that was my sponsors. And usually it was faith, reality, you know. I'll tell you very frankly, I was not completely hoping, but kind of wishing that maybe I knew what I was going to be doing when I got up here. Because this was a first for me. And I did what I usually do when I'm asked to do something that I don't know what I'm doing. I called Merck to find out if you were a friendly group. Because I figured if she got out alive, I had a halfway chance. And then I called Arbutus O'Neill in Texas because she's going to be doing the same thing in California. And neither one of them helped me a lot. So I called my sponsor. Now, I only call her on very desperate situations. I said to her, I don't know how I get myself into these damn things. And she said, I know. And I said, how? She says, you're always talking when you should be listening. I said, well, what do you think I should do? And she said, pray. And I did, all the way up here. But when Raven first told me that the theme of this conference or retreat or whatever it is you call it was to be celebrate each day, I like that. Because my method of celebrating each day now, since I have been in Al-Anon, is to work it through the 12 steps and the 12 traditions. Because each day to me today is a celebration. And she also mentioned the fact that a gal by the name of Benny was instrumental in getting something like this started. And, you know, there has to be something very special in people who can get a group like this together, spend 3 days and go home still talking to one another. Because whether you realize it or not, I realize it. If anybody had told me a few hundred years ago that I would be spending a weekend with this many women, I'd have said, you've got to be nuts. You know, but those were in the days of competition. Those were in the days when I had to compete for whatever reason, you know, and there was no celebration in those kind of days. I got to Al-Anon in October of 1957, unwanted, unloved, and alone. But that's the way I liked it. See, I was afraid of people. Not necessarily that I would be hurt, but that they might find out that I cared something about them. And that was the only weapon that anybody ever had that they could use against me. And that was the fact that if you found out that I liked you or that I cared about you, whether you were a friend or whether you were a relative, it meant that you had a weapon that you could use against me, and I was constantly afraid that you would. When I got to Al-Anon, as most of you know, I didn't come for the good reasons. It was a letter my husband wrote that got me into Al-Anon. And I wasn't altogether happy about the fact either, because this was a strange bunch of people, as far as I was concerned. You know, they, for one thing, they stood up and talked about things that I'd been hiding for years, you know. And they didn't seem to be the least bit ashamed of it. I really had a few genuine doubts about whether or not this was the type of an organization that my family would approve of me belonging to. But there's something about what goes on in a meeting and between individuals in a meeting that is almost captivating, at least it was for me, because it aroused in me a desire to have what you want, to have what you had, and to go to any length to get it. Now, that's a quote out of the Big Book, but that's all right. When I came into Al-Anon, we used the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous because we didn't have a lot of literature. We had five pieces, one printed in Toronto, one in Tucson, one in L.A., and two from New York. We had a book about that big that didn't say off a lot, but they managed to make a lot of pamphlets out of it. And then we had the Big Book of A.A. And so I'm kind of geared towards there not being necessarily any kind of a separation between the Al-Anon and the alcoholic, because it is but by the grace of God that I could have been on the other side. Because you can believe me when I tell you that if alcohol had done for me what it did for him, I'd have gotten drunk. Because it just seemed to me like he didn't have a care in the world. I tried it. I tried getting drunk lots of times. It didn't help me. It just made it harder for me to do what I thought I had to do. And it sort of generated less cooperation, too, from the people that were around me. Because I was not a happy drunk. I was a traveling drunk. Now, I don't know whether any of you relate to that or not, but Eddie used to tell people that two martinis and she'll take off for Never Never Land. And that's true, you know. I'd get an idea in my head. I should have called so-and-so in San Francisco, and it's too late to call him, so I'll just drive up. I really don't have too much quarrel with some of the things that Eddie has done today, because he was just one of those people that drank and passed out, but not me. I either telephoned or I went, one of the two. I guess it's no surprise that I identified more with the alcoholic than I did with the women. And I used to love to mention the fact that I liked to drink during the days that there was drinking, because I like to watch some of them Al-Anon squirm. I don't know whether you've ever noticed it or not, but when they come into Al-Anon and they're new, and I can only speak for Al-Anon because I haven't had that much chance to observe the alcoholic. But when the Al-Anon first comes into an Al-Anon meeting, the one thing she don't want you to think she's ever had is a good time. You know. Because no self-respecting martyr ever had a good time. And I can say that with all honesty because that's where I was. You know, I went into my first Al-Anon meeting as a condensation to help them, because that's sort of the way my sponsor had introduced me to it. I've talked a lot of times, and I've mentioned Wilma on occasion, but in my day, you didn't pick a sponsor. They gave you one. And it was primarily because I wouldn't say that Al-Anon was underground, but there were so few meetings that you didn't know where they were. And so Wilma actually was chosen for me by God, because the gal that got the original call to make a 12-step call on me had a hair appointment. We were very dedicated in those days, I bet. And besides that, she lived a little distance away, and so she called Wilma and asked Wilma if she would come over and see me. That's how I got her. And as some of you know, the first day she came to my house, she found a front door nail check, which was necessary. I mean, I was in no shape to cover two doors. I was really kind of worn out. And she finally came back that night, and she was scared, I think, because she had gone next door to ask this neighbor whether or not I was at home, and the neighbor had implied that I was crazy. And so it kind of scared her. And when she came back that night, she brought a friend with her. And I never saw that girl from that night ever again. I mean, the one that was with Wilma. I think I scared her too, you know, because they got into my house, I don't know how, and I had all these little naked bodies running around, because I used to get my kids to bed on a production basis. I put them all in the tub, get them washed, rinsed out, dried, dressed in bed, so I had a little time to worry. And the, besides that, I had always, you know, in some of my messages to a wayward husband, I would always say to Eddie, if you intend to see your children before they go to bed, you had better be here on time. And I'd hurry up and get those kids ready to go to bed before he had a chance to get home. And they would usually just get to sleep when I'd wake them up so we could go out and find out where the hell he was. And maybe that's one of the reasons that I'm a firm believer that in my particular case, my kids never reacted to the alcoholic. They always reacted to my reaction to the alcoholic because they never knew whether they were going to bed or getting up. But when Wilma came back that night and told me how sick I was, I didn't believe her. But, you know, well, what she actually told me was that I had survived something I didn't even know I had. And she told me a whole lot of other people still had it. And she was going to get them together and we were going to help them as a group. Now, that's sort of the way it sounded to me. But I didn't know what she was talking about. See, I didn't comprehend anything that was going on that I didn't initiate. Now, I don't know whether that makes sense to you or not, but if you understand that you're in the right place, I can tell you that for damn sure. But it used to go right over my head, you know. And I didn't go to my first meeting willingly. I went because I had told her I would help her with these other people she was having trouble with. And she took me to my first meeting in Azusa, California, and believe it or not, it was in the back room of a place I had once threatened to burn down. And you talk about fear. When she turned into that driveway at Selma's Cafe, I almost died because I thought, they sent her. You know, somebody knew. You know, if you're suspicious and you're fearful, you know, and if you're unwanted, unloved, and alone, you have problems. I mean, there's just no two ways about it. But I have often said, and it's true, I hope I never forget that meeting, because I hope that feeling of walking from a world of absolute chaos into a place of absolute peace. So I didn't have to explain my existence. And that was something that I had never been able to do. You know, one of the things that has attracted me to Al-Anon and kept me here is the fact that this is some place that I can be myself. This is some place where I don't have to be something or somebody that I think you think I ought to be. Now, there's another little for you, and if you understand that, you're in the right place. Because when I got to Al-Anon, I really didn't know who I was. You know, I had a name, that's true, but I never had an identity. I was always somebody's wife, somebody's mother, somebody's daughter, somebody's granddaughter, somebody's something. But I never really knew who I was. And I remember asking my sponsor one night, how do you find out who you are? And she said to me, because I've got a very sick sponsor, you're going to hear some more about her this weekend, but when I asked her that question, she said to me, well, when you have cake for dessert, how do you serve it? You understand that? I didn't. But I told her, you know, I said, well, I give a pretty good sized piece to Eddie, and then I'm very even as far as the children are concerned, and once in a while there's a piece left over for me. But most times there isn't. And she said, that's what I thought, because that's the way you live your life, too. And I said, what do you mean? She said, you take a big chunk of your life and you give it a whim. And then you're very even as far as the children are concerned. And once in a while, there's a small piece left over for you. But most times there isn't. And I said to her, well, what do you do in a case like that? She said, you take the first piece cake. And that's what I try to do one day at a time to the best of my ability. Because that, too, is a way to celebrate today, or a day, or any day, is to be able to admit to yourself, to God, and to another human being that you're just as entitled to a happy life on earth as anybody else. You know, Because left to my own devices, I was one of those people that always slipped into that crevice of unworthiness. And believe you me, it was always a hard climb back up to where I was able to admit that I was just as entitled to be happy as anybody else. But you see, I didn't know what happiness was when I came to Al-Anon. I didn't know what success was when I came to Al-Anon. All of those things are things that I had to learn as we went along. And I don't want to give it all away tonight because I do have a page here for tomorrow. be with me. Anyhow, one of the things that I had difficulty with when I got here, and they kept saying to me, it's one day at a time. And I called around the phone one day and I said, what do you mean, one day at a time? Does that mean from the time you get up in the morning until the time that you go to bed? Or how do you count it? You know, I mean, everybody counts things differently. I didn't even know what it was because I didn't go to bed. I had to stay up, you know, because I had to stay up until he got home, and then I had to stay up to keep him from going out. It was kind of a mixed-up deal, but of course, when I was first in Al-Anon, he was in the hospital, and so I really didn't have that worry. But when you get into a bad habit, it's hard to break, you know. And God thought fit to replace him with Al-Anon. And I had to stay up to learn how to work the seven because I wanted to do it perfectly. And at that time, I didn't have a big book of AA, so I didn't know that we're not supposed to be perfect. We're just supposed to grow along spiritual lines. So I didn't know what spiritual was either. I had a lot of trouble with the words. But when I asked Emma, how do you count your day? She said to me, now. I said, what do you mean, now? She said, that's today, now. I said, well, how can you measure now? And she said, well, you've been doing it for the last 10 minutes. You see, because I didn't live in the now. I lived in the yesterday or the tomorrow. I can remember on New Year's Eve, back in about 1955, thinking to myself, oh my God, I've got 364 days to go through yet. And do you know I was never disappointed? I always had 364 miserable days to go through before another year came along and I could say the same thing over and over again. So I had to learn how to live in the now. I never have really had much chance to talk about, and I'm jumping around. You can fix it, though. You can fix anything. I've had people ask me sometimes about a little bit about the how my husband happened to get into AA or decide to get into AA, and it is kind of an interesting story. As most of you know, I have 8 children altogether. And I usually make people count them as they crept in, just like I did, because I was always surprised. And as I always say, Eddie was a little shocked, too, when he sobered up. He thought I was babysitting for a living, but I had taken him on a disastrous trip back to the state of Missouri. To get him away from California. I hated California. To me, it was one large bar separated by an occasional liquor store. And we had kind of an interesting trip going back. And even though when I left California, I knew I was expecting a baby, I didn't do anything about it because I had 5 children at the time. And if you had 5 children, having a baby is no big deal, especially if you're busy, and I was. And, well, I had set up a dental office for him, rather nice dental office with patients and everything, but I could never get him in it. And then when I went up to see a doctor in Kansas City, because I had known when I left California I was expecting a baby, I figured I'd better go up and do something, and I did. And this man was a rather sadistic individual. He was rather nice, though, I guess. He helped me in, patted me down, patted me on the head, and then told me I was going to have a set of twins. Yeah, that's what I said. I almost died in his office. I wasn't really counting on one, you know. He was insisting on two. And I had problems at that time. I had a dental office, no dentist, plus five and a thing I didn't know what to do with. And besides all that, I knew what Eddie was going to say when I told him, because he said it. There are no twins in my family. I got so involved defending my moral character that I forgot there were twins in my family. It wasn't until after they arrived and my mother said, "Isn't it nice? We have another set of twins." And I said, "In whose family?" She said, "Ours." I said, "Well, why didn't you tell me?" She said, "You never asked me." Which is true. I mean, before I got to Al-Anon, I never asked anybody anything. Can you think of a better way for people to find out you don't know something than to ask them, you know? Even when I used to get lost, I'd pull into a phone station and I'd say to the attendant, "Where are you located?" I knew that if I found out where he was, I would know where I was. You see? And that was the whole point of the exerciser, that he should not know I didn't know that I was lost. That was the whole thing. But anyhow, after this disastrous trip to Missouri, I decided to bring Eddie back to California because even though I didn't like California when I left, compared to how I hated Missouri, California looked pretty good. And I got him back out to California, and it was really rather an interesting trip, you know. I don't think we lived any place more than a week and a half, you know, because I'd move in, take a look around, and if I saw a bar within walking distance, I'd move. And maybe that's why my number two son, that I never could keep in school, take him to school, he'd usually be waiting for me when I got home. And when I asked him whether he liked school or not after I got to Al-Anon and he got to Allison, and he said, "I did, sure did, Mom. But I was always afraid you'd move while I was gone, you know." And that really wouldn't have been unheard of because I never stayed any place for a very long period of time. But the hammer fell when we were living in Westchester and Eddie got arrested. And that was the thing. I had always told him, you know, if he ever lost his hair, I was going to divorce him. Never thought of him going to jail. And I had a few other things, you know, that I kept checking off because he did all of them. And finally, as I say, he got arrested. And I knew that this was it. I was just going to have to divorce him because he had become an embarrassment to my family. None of my family had ever been in jail before that I knew of at that time. And suddenly he ceased to be that tall, handsome, immaculate professional man, which he ain't, to be sort of like John Dillinger. You know, I had a very vivid imagination. You have to sort of get hep to that because I used to visualize him, you know, standing behind the bars with needing a shave and all that stuff, like you see on the TV, you know. I want you to know that when he came out of jail, he looked like he'd been on a Florida vacation. Because I'm the one that looked like I'd been in jail. because I spent the 7 days that he was supposed to be in there. That's what they sentenced him to, the 7 days for driving under the influence. Those were in the good old days. Now you get life. But I spent all that time writing him a Dear John letter and explain to him how it just was impossible for us to go on because of all of this stuff. And he called me on the phone every night to kind of help me along with the letter because I felt so embarrassed. You know, everybody was probably listening on the telephone line. Now, that's paranoia, but I didn't know I was paranoid. And he was polishing police cars, can you believe that, and loving it. Because he polished all night and then he got the sun all day on the roof of the jail. And when he called me and told me he got 2 days off of being such a good polisher, I wanted to file suit against the city because I hadn't finished the letter yet. But I went down to Lincoln Heights. I didn't go in because I didn't want anybody to think I knew anybody in there. So I sat across the street like I was doing charity work for the Red Cross. And he walked out of that jail, up to that car, and he raised his hand and he said, "Winnie, I will never take another drink as long as I live." And you can believe this or not, I forgot the whole damn speech. I had been practicing for 5 days, you know. You could wake me up in the middle of the night and I'd start right off with what it was I had been writing. So anyhow, I believed him though to the point that I got a house out in Temple City, a house that was built for me in about 1898. It looked like a typical haunted house that was waiting for a ghost that finally got there. Because the little old lady that took me through it had gone into it as a bride, so she thought like it used to be. I thought like it was, but it was sort of a meeting of the minds, you might say. She took me down and, or showed me rather, what I guess was a fruit cellar or some damn thing. It had a sod floor, I know. And she kind of nudged me and she says, "It's a wonderful place to hide things." And I agreed with him, you know, I figured a sharp shovel, I can plant him in the basement, nobody else. You know. So I was the only one that ever looked for him anyhow. But anyhow, while we were in this house, and I want to tell you a little bit about this house. It was furnished. And the furniture, I think, had been there since about 1898. The only damn thing in the house that worked, really, was the piano. And I used to sit down at the piano after I got the kids to bed and composed my messages to the wayward husband with a musical background. And there were a few keys that stuck, but I fooled around with the piano long enough to find out that I could play Onward Christian Soldiers without anything sticking, you know. So after I got the kids to bed, I'd sit down and play Onward Christian Soldiers, you know. And those kids would sleep the whole time I played. But the minute I stopped, they were wide awake. Because they knew either he was home or we were leaving. It was one of the two, you know. Never even had to wake him up. But it was about this time that I wasn't feeling too well, and I didn't know what was the matter with me. And I went up to Arcadia to see a doctor. And, of course, the first thing he said to me was, "Mrs. Eddy, you're going to have a baby." And I almost died again, you know. I mean, I just couldn't understand this at all. I'm a good Catholic, but he was a Methodist, right? Just couldn't quite make the connection. But this doctor said one thing to me that nobody else had ever said to me before. He said, "There's about 1 chance in 100 that this will be a full-term pregnancy." And that's all I heard that man say. I went out of his office knowing that I didn't know where, I didn't know when, I didn't know how, but I did know that this time I was not going to have a baby. Now, you may not believe this, but it's the gospel truth. I did not gain enough weight that anybody in my family, even my husband, knew that I was expecting a baby. A doctor in Alcoholics Anonymous has told me that it's a classic case of self-hypnosis. That you can believe something so strongly in your own mind that even your physical appearance will take on that which you have stressed out on. Because when the light went on for Eddie again and he told me he wanted to go to San Francisco and to go into practice with a doctor he'd been in the Navy with, I volunteered to drive him up. Now, I knew that if I was going to have that baby about now was the time, but as long as I wasn't, I figured I'd take him up. And we left Los Angeles, drove as fast as I could go to San Francisco to keep get him up there before the light went out. I dropped him off and headed back to Los Angeles. I wanted to get the hell out of there, too, you know. So I dropped him off, headed back to L.A., and we stopped at the beach, and we went to a drive-in movie, and we did a lot of other things. And I had this funny feeling that I didn't hurt any place, and I think I was tired. You know, I had a doctor friend that told me that I'm going to die from self-diagnosis because I always prescribe for myself. But anyhow, I finally got him back to Temple City, and I told my oldest son, Butch, that I was going to run down to the general hospital and get something to make me feel better. Now, there's 15 miles of freeway driving between where I was and the general hospital. I drove those 15 miles by myself. I parked in a 15-minute parking zone. And I went into the emergency room, and I told the nurse that I didn't feel well. And she said, well, you're going to have a baby. And I said, no, I am not. And we argued all the way up to the 8th floor. And George, my youngest son, is probably the smartest kid I ever had, because he knew he was coming all the time, and I didn't know until the elevator stopped. But I kept telling them idiots that I was parked in a 15-minute parking zone, and I had to move my car, but they were very unfeeling people. And I finally got my clothes back, and I was parading up and down the hall, wanting the keys to my car, and they wouldn't give me the keys to my car. And so when they asked me who I was, I don't cooperate with people like that. And I told them, find out for yourself. And they did, off the registration of the car. And they sent a deputy sheriff out to my mother's house to ask her to please come down and try to quiet me, you know. And by the time she got back there, I was still threatening them with what I was going to do to them. But it didn't seem to upset them. They kept saying to me, you have to leave the baby. And I kept saying, I'll be back if they didn't believe me. I don't know why, but they didn't. And why I never ended up in psycho, I'll never know either. But she convinced me that if I would go with her that night, that we would come back the next day and get the car. And believe you me, I didn't rest until I went back the next day and got that car. But I didn't know until I got to Al-Anon why that car was so important to me. That car was my means of escape. When things got too heavy for me here, I got in the car and I went someplace else. The thing that Al-Anon showed me was that the reason that I could never escape in that car is because I was the monster that was chasing me, and I was doing the driving. But after I got the car, then I had to write a letter to Lloyd John and tell him he had a new son. This is not an easy letter to write. I'd only dropped him off the day before. But I wrote the letter. I sent a special delivery because I didn't want him to think I was keeping things from him. And he got it. And he headed back to Los Angeles to find out what in the name of heaven was going on, you know. I always seem to surprise him with certain little things. And on the way down from San Francisco, Eddie was arrested and put off a bus in Santa Barbara. And when he called me on the phone to do something about it, my mother was standing right beside me. And for the first time in my life, my mother gave me an order that I couldn't refuse. She said, you do one thing to help him, and you don't need to call me ever again. And a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. So I just told him there was nothing I could do. And he spent a weekend in the jail in Santa Barbara. And when he went before the judge on Monday morning, the judge happened to have heard of Alcoholics Anonymous, which had just started in the Santa Barbara area. And he was as confused about Eddie's condition as I had been, and anybody that knew him had been. He couldn't figure out how a doctor could be so drunk on a bus that a bus driver would put him out and have him arrested, nor why he would sit in jail during that weekend when he had plenty of money to bail himself out. So I knew why he wouldn't bail himself. I'd never bail himself out of anything. He always had plenty of money because I always bailed him out, just so that people wouldn't think I couldn't afford to, you know, that crazy paranoia again. But anyhow, this judge called this answering service of AA and asked them to send somebody over who wanted to talk to them. And when the guy got there, the judge took the call from AA, Eddie, and went into his chambers, and he said to the guy from Alcoholics Anonymous, what do you think he needs? And Eddie said the guy looked at him for just about a minute and a half, and then he said, I think he needs a drink. And Lord John says, that's the first time in my entire life that anyone had actually said precisely how I felt. I did need a drink. So the judge dismissed the charges. The guy took Eddie to the to the bus station. He still had his ticket. He bought him a drink and he put him on the bus. And when Eddie got back to Los Angeles, he said to me, "I think I'm going to go into the hospital and do something about my drinking." Now, to the best of my recollection, that's the first time that drinking was ever mentioned as being the problem or having anything to do with the problem. It certainly never occurred to me. Because as some of you have heard, or maybe many of you have heard me say, I never came to drinking. I didn't want Eddie to come to Alcoholics Anonymous and quit drinking. I just wanted him to learn the mind. That was all, you know. And in the days that he went into the hospital, they didn't have treatment centers. What you had to do was to go through court and have yourself committed. And usually it was a two-year commitment, and they had 90 days of an alcoholic rehabilitation, and at the end of the 90 days, then they called me, well, me, into a very official-looking office, and they gave me an official-looking piece of paper about that day that they wanted me to sign, and I read it, and it said, "He had to mind me." Now, I had, at that point, had about 90 days of Al-Anon, just enough to take my responsibility seriously. And I want you to know that for a long while there, his life wasn't worth living. I would give him just time enough to get to the meeting, so he could have a cup of coffee first. And then after the meeting, he could also have a cup of coffee. But he'd better be home by a certain length of time. He didn't pay any attention to me. I was still doing the same things I'd done before. Because in Al-Anon, at least for me, it was very difficult for me to accept his sobriety. You see, his drinking I had pretty well under control. I knew pretty much what he was going to do. But then he got sober. And he'd call me on the phone. He'd say, "I'll be home at 5 o'clock, and damned if he wasn't." And I was never ready for him. See? Because my mind would say he was here at 8 o'clock, so 8 o'clock is what I was planning on. Then he'd walk in, you know. And he got to where he noticed if I hadn't done his laundry. There were a lot of little things that he began to notice. And I guess that's when I really began to want to do something to change the way I was feeling. I'd many times said alcohol got me here, but it didn't keep me here. What kept me here was that certain something that I have found in Al-Anon, and I'm sure you have found in Al-Anon or AA, whichever it happens to be. That sort of a mystery that we never quite conquer, but we taste it once in a while, just often enough to keep you coming back to see if maybe you can't get a bigger slice next time. When I was new in Al-Anon, I had a lot of trouble. I took everything literally. And I believed everybody. Now, that's a miracle. I've often said that you have to be kind of careful of what you say to the newcomers these days, and even in those days. Because I was in a meeting one night when a gal walked up to me and she said, "Winnie, I understand you have quite a few children." And I said, "Yes, I do." And she said, "And your husband's in the hospital?" I said, "Yes, he is." And she said, "Well, have you been to the welfare office?" And I said, "No." And she said, "Well, you should go to the welfare office." And I said, "Okay." And so the next day I called my mother and I said, "I have to go to the welfare office." And she said, "Why?" And I said, "I don't know." "But I have to go to the welfare office." And I asked her if she would come out and look after the kids while I went to the welfare office. I didn't even know where it was at first. I had to look it up. And when she got there, I followed her car because I thought it looked better than mine. And I went, got all dressed up and best clothes, walked into the welfare office, and they handed me some papers. And I sat down at the little place they had there, and it says, "How much money do you have in the bank?" And I told them. "And do you own any property?" And I told him. "And do you have any cars?" And I told him. I was as honest as anybody could be in Al-Anon. I told him exactly the whole truth. And then I gave the papers back to the lady and sat down. And then they called my name. And I went into this little cubby hole, and there was a man sitting on... I'm embarrassed to think about it. This guy was sitting in this little cubby hole with my application. And he said to me, "Why are you here?" And I said, "Well, I'm an Al-Anon." And he said, "Yes." He didn't ask me what it was. He just said, "Yes." And then pretty soon he said, "Well, but why are you here?" And I said, "Because I am in Al-Anon." We must have spent 15 minutes on that routine until he made me mad enough that I just took my papers back and left. And as soon as I got home, I called and reported them to my sponsor. And of course, Wilma didn't even know that I had gone up there, you know, because it wasn't she that had asked me. But it taught me a lesson that I have used in later life, and that is that I try very hard when I'm talking to a newcomer to explain to them what I'm talking about, you know, because I had also a disastrous 12-foot fall. And I've been in Al-Anon for quite a while, but this little gal was Oriental. And she didn't speak a whole lot of English, and I didn't speak any Japanese. And I thought I made a pretty good call on her, to tell you the gospel truth, that she called me about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and I'd called on her about 11, and she told me she was in the mental hospital. And I said, "What are you doing in the mental hospital?" And she said, "I just did what you told me." I said, "You did what I told you? And you ended up in a psycho ward?" And her name was Yaiko. I'll never forget it if I live to be a million, because what I had said to her was, "You have to be willing to give up everything." She gave the neighbors everything she had. And when her husband came home, the house, the neighbors were still carrying it out. And he thought she flipped. So he had her committed. And I didn't see too awful much of her after that. It was really kind of one of my failures. And yet, several years after that happened, I got a note from the Arlington meeting in Los Angeles, and it was from this little gal, Yaiko. And it just said, "Thank you," and she was still going to Al-Anon. Not thanks to me, but I didn't know at that time that, you know, things that we say in English mean something entirely different to them. And but she got that message all right. It was kind of fun. But this is a part of the way that I believe we celebrate each day. Not necessarily with our successes, but with our failures. Because I don't know about you, but I was not a real quick learner when I was successful. When I was successful, I was inclined to slide. But when I made a mistake, I was inclined to try harder so that I would never have to feel that way again. And that's another one of the things that my sponsor used to say to me when I would say to her, "How long is this going to go on?" And she'd say, "Till you're tired of it." And that's about how long it went on. I used to be her trial, I guess, because she was a great one for throwing, slogans, you know. She'd say, "First things first." I don't know what she meant. I mean, if somebody said that to you, what would you say? One day I decided I'd better find out what it was, so I went back to bed, and I was working on the program, and she came over, and my kids brought her right up to the bedroom, and she walked in, and she said, "Are you sick?" And I said, "No, I'm working the program." And she said, "Oh, really? What are you doing?" And I said, "What you keep telling me, first things first." And I showed her my clipboard, and I had written on the clipboard, "Do the dishes, make the beds, this, that, and the other thing," and I was switching them around according to their importance. And I can still hear her voice when she said to me, "Did it ever occur to you that you have to get up?" And that wasn't even on the clipboard. you know. But this is just sort of a preview of the complications that an intelligent, well-raised, I'm missing my assets. I don't have them anymore, but I had them when I got here. You know, I thought I was so bright, and I was. I was so bright I couldn't see, because I couldn't understand even the simplest of things that they tried to tell me. But I will tell you that the very first time that I knew I had changed or that I had grown an Al-Anon was at a meeting one night when, at the coffee break, one of the girls leaned over to me and she said, "Winnie, did you know there's a doctor's wife in this group?" And I said, "You're kidding." And she said, "No, there is." And I sat back down after the coffee break and I watched them. Trying to figure out which one it was, you know. And it turned out to be me. And it was the first time, I believe, in my entire life that I didn't go someplace trying to be what I thought you thought I should be, which is what I said before. You see, when I got here, I was an idiot to like. And if you don't think it isn't hard to try to be a PTA-er and a choir singer and an artist society, something, you know, if they all fall on the same day, you're in a very busy state of mind, because I had a different personality for everything I did, you know. And I don't know how I would have survived it, except that I guess God wanted me as a bad example. That's what my sponsor told me when I, you know, was going to graduate from this outfit. And she said to me, "Well, it's up to you to think it over. You know, you may never be a good example, but you can always be a bad one." And I got to thinking about it, and when you're nothing, being a bad example is a promotion. You know, at least when people say, "What are you?" you can say, "I'm a bad example." And that kind of takes care of it. Anyhow, I'm not so sure what else. Is there any questions that you'd like to ask me? I've run out of things to think about, you know. I've got a lot of things I did, but I'm not sure I want to tell you about them. Any questions? Anybody like to ask me? Get me started on something else? My father?
Yes.
Oh! My father, when I first got to Al-Anon, I used to say that my father was an alcoholic because he did quite a bit of drinking, and his drinking bothered me. You know, never bothered my mother, never bothered my brothers or sisters, but it always bothered me. And like I said, when I first got to Al-Anon, I used to call him an alcoholic, but I couldn't spot an alcoholic 2 miles away, you know, anybody going into a bar, coming out of a bar, standing in front of a liquor store, just looking strange as an alcoholic. And this is a little ahead of the whole damn thing, but my older son called me not so long ago, and he says, "Mom, do you think I'm an alcoholic?" And I said, "I don't know. I can't tell you whether you're an alcoholic or not." And he said, "Well, I'm not." And I said, "Okay, if you're not, you're not." And he said, "Well, do you think I am?" And I said, "Well, Butch, I can't really answer that question for you. But I will ask you a question that may help you answer your own question." And he said, "What's that?" And I said, "How many times have you been arrested sober?" And he hung up on me, so I won't have to listen to him for another 6 months. But anyhow, my dad was a golf professional. And in that particular profession, as any of you who play golf know, the 19th hole is very available. And he was not a person that, he wasn't abusive. He never deprived me of anything. My mother, I think we were discussing it on the way up, I think I had a kind of a resentment against my mother, because I knew that she could make him do anything that she wanted him to do. And she never, ever tried to make him do what I thought he should do. Well, there's another riddle for you. If you understand that, you're in the right place too. The example I use a lot of times is when my dad would come home, he'd, you know, he always ended up on the living room floor. He'd sit down, lean down, and lay down, you know. And she always used to say to us, that's his business. You tend to your business and we'll have no problem. So I used to step over him and go about my business. But you see, I should have stepped on him. Because it was during those years, it was not his behavior that bothered me. It was the fact that he embarrassed me. I think I must have been a born snob. I can't figure out any other way, you know, because I was always trying to make people do what I wanted them to do so that I would look good. Now, does that make sense to you? You know, and 9 out of 10 times you wouldn't do it. I always say that, and it's true, you know, I used to go to my friends' houses and I would watch their fathers and wish that my father could be like them. And yet, today, since I have had a little more sanity under my belt, I didn't trade my growing up for anything under the sun because I had a lot of very good experiences that I was too sick to accept and appreciate at the time. But thank God I got a good memory because after I got to Al-Anon and somebody asked me almost that exact same question, you know, because as I say, when I first got to Al-Anon, I used to refer to my father as being an alcoholic. And I was able, because of this program, and because of the first step and a few other things that I had to do in order to grow in this way of life, I was able to discover that there were very few bad things that happened to me as I was growing up. Most of them were good. But I'm a negative individual. You give me a problem or a happy time, and I'll take the problem every time. Because, you see, until I got to Al-Anon, I didn't really know how to be happy. I thought happy was something like you got as a gift. And I had to be around Al-Anon long enough to find out that at least my happiness is not the culmination of what's going on, but the journey towards the culmination. The fun that I have, that I remember. This trip down from the airport tonight, we had a ball. I mean, we worried about you. But what can you do, you know, except the things you cannot change? That's the whole thing. And we turned it over to God and asked him to give us an excuse, and he did. He put a student driver, truck driver, ahead of us on a mountain road. But he didn't last long enough for us to use it as an excuse, so we built the dimensionist there. But the idea of growing up in a family, I talked at a meeting, a type of meeting, and I won't say what type of meeting, but anyhow, I didn't know what type it was when I got into it. And afterwards, this guy caught me in the parking lot, and he said to me, do you realize that your father's drinking conditioned you to marry a potential alcoholic, which practically ruined your entire life? I was almost feeling sorry for myself when he put it that way, you know. And then he expounded a little bit further, and I was getting a little irritated with him for some reason or other. And why I said it, I don't really know, except it was something I guess I was supposed to hear, because I said to him, supposing I accept your hypothesis that my father's drinking conditioned me to marry a potential alcoholic, which got me to Al-Anon. It saved me from that miserable life that I was headed for. I said, how can you, by any stretch of the imagination, blame somebody who gives you what I have been given because of their illness? And that's the way I feel about it. My brothers, I had a brother that was a little nuts, and I don't know where he is, and I quit worrying about him. You know, my mother used to worry about it, and I used to say to her, well, I'll go get him if you find him. And then one day she said to me, I'm not going to look for him. And I said, fine, so we're doing good, you know. At one time I wouldn't have been able to admit that. Because I would have had to have a family that, I got some good relatives, you know, but I got this one bad one. And, yeah, I don't know that he's doing anything bad, but I don't know where he is. I don't think he knows that my mother and father have passed away, nor that my sister and my other brother have passed away. But, that's not my problem. You see, that's one of the bonuses that I got right here in a room like this, with people like you. And that was that I don't have to be unhappy unless I want to. There's plenty of things that can make you unhappy. This sister of mine, she was very, very well. She had a problem with alcohol, I believe. I truly believe she did. And her illness taught me a lesson that I hope I never forget, because when she first told me she wasn't feeling well and that she'd lost a lot of weight, I said to her, well, if you'd change your way of life, you'd probably find out that you'd feel better. And that was about in February. In May, her daughter called me and she said, Aunt Winnie, would you please go up and talk to my mother? I can't get her to go to the doctor, and I think she's very sick. And when I went up to see her, she was in the final stages of pancreas cancer. Although we didn't know that at the time. I took her to the hospital that day, and she lived 3 weeks after that. But she taught me a lesson that I hope I never forget. And that is, don't, for me, try to think that you know. Just because the drinking was an obvious ailment, it wasn't the drinking. It was a slip. If I'd ever had a slip in my life, I had it that day. When I allowed my snobbish attitude towards drinking to deprive her of what might have helped her or might not have helped her. I don't grieve about it. Don't misunderstand me. In fact, I have two maiden aunts in New York that wanted to know. They couldn't come out because of their age, and so they wanted me to write them a detailed letter about everything that went on, and I did. And Peggy, knowing that she was going to die, had set up her own arrangements. And one of the things she said she wanted was to have a place in Forest Lawn that was close to the freeway, because then she'd never be lonely. I told you, that's the way she wanted it, and that's what she got. So when I wrote and told these aunts that information, and one of them wrote back and said to me, well, how close is she to the freeway? And I wrote back and said, dear Aunt Winifred, if we have another earthquake, she'll be in the right-hand lane. I know to some people that may sound disrespectful, but it's the truth, you know, and these aunts still think I'm sick. Only now there's an Eddie fault, it's your fault. They keep saying to me, we do strange things since she's joined that organization, you know, and I do strange things, like tell the truth and other things, you know, where I used to lie. But anyhow, it's fun. And we had a question back there. Oh, and there's a letter that my husband wrote. When he went into the hospital, at Camarillo State Hospital, he had to agree to attend AA meetings. And it was at an AA meeting that he heard about Al-Anon. And he's the one that wrote the letter to the Al-Anon central office and told those complete strangers that there was something wrong with me. You know, there's nuts sitting in Camarillo State Hospital. No wonder when I found that out, I just could not be moved that he would do something like that to me. You know, it was... Have you ever visited anybody in a nut house? When you're well? Yeah, and you hear that door close behind you. You can almost hear the lock click. And then you look around and all them nuts look just like you. You know. And the first couple of times I went up there, I used to think, oh, God, I hope they don't change the guards before I go out. Because the first thing I did was ask him what his name was so we could kind of strike up a friendship, you know. And I went through the tortures of the damned. I tell you, but all those experiences were necessary. You know, the only people that I really thought were okay were the psychos. You know, I couldn't tell a nurse from a nut. And Eddie, of course, was helping the dentist. I could have killed him, you know. I couldn't get him to work for nothing, and this damn dentist had him working on all these nuts. And I used to think, well, he deserves it, you know, I mean, after all. But it was an experience. He got a job up there, too. He was washing dishes in the employee's dining room because they had better food. And I went up one day to visit him, and he got in the car, and he said, "When you drive down here," so I drove down there, and he said, "Now make a left," and I made a left. And at the next corner, he said, "Make another left," and I made another left. He said, "Stop," and I stopped. And he jumped out of the car and ran down into the bushes, and I thought, "Jesus, Mary and Joseph, you know, he has really clipped his head." And a few minutes later, he came back shaking his head, and I thought, "I wonder what's wrong," you know, and I said, "Are you sick?" He says, "No." He said, "They have some real nice divided plates in the dining room, and I thought maybe the kids would like them, so I hid some in the bushes, but some dummy took them." You know, he and I really deserved one another. I don't know how we got together, but we deserved one another. And it was something else. But that's how I got into Al-Anon. There's been many Al-Anons wondering how I got in, too. They want to plug that hole. It's one of those things. But anyhow, it's anything else? I'm here. No questions. I'll be in better shape tomorrow. Right now I'm still riding in the back of Kathy's car. But I don't know why I wrote all this stuff. I haven't said one damn thing that's on this paper yet. But maybe I saved you a lot of something. You know, I could have said all this stuff and it wouldn't have meant a thing to you now that I read it over. You ever do that? Do you ever write things and then be grateful you didn't know them? When I was about a year and a half in Al-Anon, my sponsor, whose husband was one of these oil lease men, she came up to Oregon. I hated Oregon for a long, long time because I couldn't believe that she would leave me in the midst of my illness, because that's one of the first things they tell you, you know, when you go to Al-Anon, you're sick. I didn't really believe them, but if they wanted me to be sick, I was willing to be sick, to stick around, you know. And when she went to Oregon, I used to write her letters 2-3 a day. Only mailed, I think, 3. But I didn't know then the therapy that you can get by sitting down and just writing how you feel or what's going on, or a letter to somebody, or whatever. But just being able to communicate with yourself on a piece of paper, at least for me, was good. Wilma gave me that as a lesson one time. She told me to write letters to God. See why I thought she was nuts. I talked to him all the time, but I'd never written it before. And I'd sit down at night and I'd write, "Dear God," and then I'd write how the day went. And she used to say to me, "After you write them and after you read them, burn them." Well, I'm a collector type. I mean, I've never thrown anything away in my whole life. I get upset if I lose something. And I used to keep these things, you know, and I kept them in my purse because, well, I wanted somebody else to find them and know I was writing to God. And I was going down the freeway one day and some dummy just swerved in front of me, and I had to hit the brake, and it looked like I was going to hit the center divider, you know. Now, I wasn't afraid of getting killed or wrecking the car. I was afraid I'd get knocked out and they'd find them letters to God and put me in a psycho ward someplace, you know. So as soon as I found out I wasn't going to die or get hurt, I went home and burned those darn letters. And but it's fun, isn't it? Great to be alive, to be able to celebrate a day. What would you say a day is? Do you agree with my sponsor that it's now?
Yeah.
So do I. Because this is probably the most important time in our lives, right here, right now. I'm not sure why I'm here, but this must be where I'm supposed to be, because this is where I am. You know, and that has cut down a great deal on my worrying about the way things are going to go or what's happening around me. You know, I didn't have a worry in the world tonight. I just got off the plane finally, and Kathy was right there, And we went to Salem, and Kathy was right there. Sounds like I'm stuttering, but I'm not. They're both named Kathy. And then we headed up here, you know, and I'll tell you one thing, Oregon's got a hell of a lot of trees. I've never seen so many trees in my whole life. But they're beautiful, you know. And thank God, because of places like this and people like you, I can see the beauty. Not just in the forest, but in the trees. Halfway up here, I discovered that the river had been running the wrong direction. And I just happened to mention to Kathy that I thought we were going uphill, but the river was running, no, we were going downhill and the river was running uphill. And she said, no, it's running downhill. And I watched it for about 4 miles, and I still thought it was going uphill. It was, you know, but that's okay. So I, at one time, I'd have had to do a little research on that. But today, I can take her word for it and enjoy the river, and it doesn't make a whole lot of difference. So I guess that's all from me for tonight. Hopefully tomorrow I'll be make a little more sense. And I want to thank the committee, Raven, Kathy, and all of you for inviting me up here to do whatever it is I'm supposed to do. And tonight I'm going to pray on it, and tomorrow, if you don't like what goes on, you can blame him, because I'm turning it over tonight. That's all there is.
This is the end of session one, the start of session two.
Good morning, everybody. I hope it is. I say that every morning, and it's just like when people say to me, how are you? And I say, fine. I know if I say it long enough, someday I'll be telling the absolute truth. And, but this, I just can't get over this place. I really can't. I've been some beautiful places, but never any place where they lull you to sleep with the, you know, brain yes, but river no. I was talking to some of the gals over in the dining room this morning about miracles. And I've always believed that my coming to Al-Anon was a miracle, because it was one of the things that Eddie got me into again. And I'm one of those people that can never do anything a little bit. If I get involved with it, I have to go to the end of the road, even though I know that there's a drop. When I get there, I still have to keep going in order to survive. And so I think the fact that he wrote the letter that got me to Al-Anon was a miracle, because I don't know whether you're familiar with doctors' writing or not. But I still have letters I got from him in 1942 that I haven't been able to decipher. So the fact that they could read it in the Al-Anon office and find out what it was that he was talking about is a miracle. And when I went to my first meeting, the gal that was leading the meeting was a person who had 6 children. I had 8, so there was an identification there. She wasn't any happier about it than I was, so there was an identification there. And her mother-in-law was supposed to have been the speaker. And she happened to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and at the last minute had called Marty to tell her that she had gotten a 12-step call, which she was committed to, so she wouldn't be able to speak. So Marty was mad at her mother-in-law, so there was another identification. Plus, she smoked my brand of cigarettes. So as I look back, you know, I could find all these various and sundry things, but I think the miracle of the whole thing was that her mother-in-law was a woman that I had been on the altar society with at St. Augustine's Church. And I had fought with that woman for 3 years. We had the craziest mixed-up altar you ever saw in your life. I didn't know Irene was drunk, and she didn't know I was crazy. And we were both rather strong personalities, and so the priest never knew whether he was going to have the same kind of flowers on both sides of the altar or not, because it just depended on whether we compromised or whether one or the other of us won. But I truly believe that I walked in and seen Irene sitting in that room, I would have turned around and walked out, because I didn't have to be involved with her anymore. You know, I had prayed against her every time we went to Mass. And so as I look at things in retrospect, I believe that that my entire existence, as far as Al-Anon and AA are concerned, has been one miracle, or maybe a coincidence, you know, after another. I like the definition that I heard one time in an AA meeting, that a coincidence is a minor miracle in which God wishes to remain anonymous. And I like that idea, you know. When I got to Al-Anon, as I told you last night, and if I repeat, well, maybe it's because I didn't say it the right way the first time, but I was not all that enthralled with the 12 steps, you know. In the first place, it didn't tell you how to work them. And they kept talking about working the 12 steps. And I didn't see any instructions. And besides that, most of them didn't make any sense, you know. The first one said, I'm powerless over alcohol and my life has become unmanageable. Well, if you're of an intelligent nature, you can figure that out right off the bat, you see. I could take alcohol or leave it alone, and if it hadn't been for him, I'd have managed beautifully. So I figured that was his step, so I left it for him. And I continued that, you know, I was smart enough not to tell them that I had skipped the first one, because I had met some people in that meeting that really, I didn't know whether the first step applied to them or not, but if there was a chance for recovery in it, they needed it, because these women, and I was never fond of women, you know, I think it's because of the competitiveness, you know, I always felt like I was competing with them. Now, I don't know what the prize was, unless it was that thing I was married to, but I really don't think I saw the man I married until I got to Al-Anon, you know, because I'm not sure I made such a great choice, but that's all beside the point, you know. I always thought he was tall and handsome, short and kind of pudgy now, but I never really saw him. And my sponsor, you know, she'd say, take the first step or whatever, and I'd say to her, oh, I have. And I've never been powerless over anything. I just never felt that there wasn't something I could do about something that would make it a little bit better. You know, I never knew that my solutions were really my problem. And so I kept getting worse and worse after I came to Al-Anon, because you see, I was losing the ability to play the game, and I didn't know it. And I would go into those rooms, and they would be happy and laughing and talking. Now, I didn't really have any big problems. Eddie wasn't at home. And I did pretty well working this program while he was in the hospital, because I had those kids regimented to where they did it. They didn't even know why they were doing it, you know. So they weren't bothering me, and Eddie was gone, so he wasn't bothering me. And so I had to have something bother me, and then women was an answer to a prayer, you know. Because there was one female in that group that I always mention when I talk that was the nastiest woman I have ever come in contact with. And she was possibly another one of the miracles that I continued to go to Al-Anon, because my first inclination was to outfit her. You know, if you've ever, I don't know how many of you have ever been married to somebody who was in the service, but that's one of the requirements, is that you're able to outfit most people, because you don't want to be the first guy to leave, because then they talk about you. So you have to be the last guy to leave so that you can do all the talking. And I carried that idea right into the Al-Anon meeting, but Glenys used to look at me when I was new, and she just shake her head, you know. And I couldn't understand that, because I'm one of those people today that I go, wherever I go, and I go comfortably. Now, there is a thing in Al-Anon that has started about dressing. You must be dressed a certain way in order to participate. Now, I don't know whether that's gotten up here to Oregon or not, but it's pretty prevalent in California, and I've always been kind of a something or other. I don't know what they call me, but I always say different. And I've never seen a dress code in Al-Anon or in AA, in all the stuff I've been meeting. But that's somewhat brainwashed to think that you can't get up and share unless you're dressed to the teeth. Well, hell, I was dressed to the teeth when I came in, because that was the way it was supposed to be. Now, I was miserable, but I had all of the finery, you know. I even did condescend not to wear a fur coat one night, because there was already one woman there that had one that was longer than mine. And these were the things that were important in my life. See, these were the things I noticed. But I almost missed one entire conference one year because I was changing my clothes, you know. Because I didn't know how it was in Al-Anon or AA, but I did know that if you wore the same thing to two officers' wives meeting in the Navy, people talked about you. You know, it's like you only had one guest. And so when I go someplace today, I go and I always tell them, it's comfort or cancel. It's up to you. I don't care which, you know. Because that to me is the freedom, one of the freedoms that they gave me. But getting back to that first step, I struggled with that for so long that finally my sponsor, in more or less desperation, I suppose, took the word alcohol out of the first step completely. Because she recognized I was allergic to the word. And she put my name in there. And she said, now work it. That's been some 31 and a half years ago. And yet, as I stand here right this minute and I say to you, I'm powerless over Winnie, and my life has become unmanageable. It tells me who louses up my life. It takes away every excuse that I have ever had for the situations that I find myself in. Because it is me who louses up my life. And it took me a long time before it really sunk in. You know, I would do something and realize that I had done it without even thinking. It was just so inbred in me to do the wrong thing that I did it without thinking. I did it automatically. And so the powerlessness of that I had over my own life because of my own actions was really kind of a startling revelation to me. And it still is to this day, you know. I didn't understand the word powerless. Can you believe that? I sometimes use as an example this flying business. I'm not the world's greatest flyer. And I probably wouldn't fly if I didn't have to. But the reason I'm not a good flyer is because I'm out of control. I'm absolutely powerless when I step on that plane, you know. And the first time I ever made a plane trip, one of the Al-Anon gals gave me a little card as a going away present. You know, Al-Anons are sadistic. I don't know whether you agree with that or not, but I've found them to be sadistic. And this gal gave me a card, which I thought was so nice of her, you know, until I opened it up. And on the front of it, it had the worst looking plane you ever saw in your life. You know, even the wings turned up. And up at the top it said, I have just spoken to your pilot, and he's not the least bit worried. And when you open it up, the pilot looked worse than the plane. And it said, drunk, yes. Worried, no. So she had managed to pick up on both my fears. But anyhow, getting back to this meeting and with these people, it was just about this time and that the word release came into existence. And I don't know what they call it now, but my sponsor, because I was one of those people that had to be kept busy. See, I couldn't stand to do nothing. I'd sit there and I'd say to him, I have to do something. And she'd say, you are doing something. And I'd say, no, I'm not. And she'd say, yes, you are. And I'd say, what am I doing? And she said, nothing. And I didn't realize that doing nothing was doing something. You know, I still don't quite understand that, but I was never still for a minute. See, I always went through life like something was chasing me. And for me to sit still was just almost more than I could stand. And so she used to give me little things to do so I'd feel like I was earning my keep in life, I guess. And when this thing about release came out, She gave it to me, and she said, now we want one for each member of the group, a copy for each member of the group. And there's about 15, but make 25, we may need some extras. So I typed it 25 times. She didn't mention carbon paper. I never thought of it, you know. And when I took it to the meeting, every place that the word release appeared, I had spelled it R-E-L-E-A-S-H. That was really what I did, you know. She always said it was a Freudian slip because they'd say let go and I'd let go until you got just so far and then I'd pull you back. And so I was just never able to just let it go, you know. It was just like nothing. I didn't understand letting go or nothing. I finally got to the second step. I kind of ignored that. I gave that to Eddie, too, in the beginning because of the unfortunate word. Came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. Now, I'm sitting in Central City, California, in my own house with my car and my kids and everything, and he's sitting in a California State Hospital. And they want me to admit that there's a power greater than myself that's going to restore me to sanity. And if you analyze these steps one at a time, you will find that very few of them apply to you. You know, I let that one for him too. But after Wilma found out what I was doing, I had to go back to some of these. And really that second step, well, I began to think of some of the things that I had done, you know. For instance, one of my favorite pastimes was hiding his car. I'd find out where it was, and then I'd put it in the one place I knew he'd never look for it, the garage. And then I'd watch him while he just went all over town looking for his damn car. And when I thought he had been punished enough, then when he wasn't there, I'd take the car out of the garage and put it right back where I'd gotten it from. Now, maybe that isn't crazy, but the pleasure that I used to get out of listening to him mumble, I know I looked there, you know. He thought he was losing his mind because he had looked and there it was, you know. And my other favorite thing was if I wanted to keep him at home, I had various methods. In fact, I'm living with some of the methods that I used. If I'd have known I was going to be married to that jerk for this long, I'd have trained him differently. Because a lot of the things that I taught him, I'm now stuck with, you know. Like serving him his meal in front of the TV if he's watching a baseball game or a hockey game or something, you know. Right in the middle of Perry Mason, which is what I like to watch. Anyhow, he's a very neat individual. And he has everything is arranged just so. You know, he could go into a dark room in the middle of the night, reach into the right drawer, and come up with the right pair of black socks. Now, that's disgusting. And when I used to get the idea of keeping him at home, you know, I used to switch the drawers on him. Because that used to drive him crazy, you know, because he never thought of just switching the drawers back. He'd take everything out of that and arrange it all back. And yet, I couldn't relate to the word sanity. You see, I thought I was the saner of the two. But in the final definition of the word sanity, to me, do you know what it was? It was you. I couldn't understand you people. You did the damnedest things I've ever seen in my life. I wouldn't do what you were doing. Because you were happy.